solvents, foul tastes, odors, heavy metals, and nitrates. It is so powerful, it purifies raw, untreated water from remote lakes, streams, and stagnant ponds.
Get the Advanced Berkey Light Purifier for only $279 by calling New Millennium, 888-803-4438, or order on the web at berkeywater.com.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. And for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Mr. Douglas Feith, and we're going to be talking about his book, War and Decision, as subtitled, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. And Mr. Feith held a high position, Under Secretary of State. What was your exact position, Mr. Feith?
I was the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy.
Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. And, of course, this gives you a tremendous insight into what the thought process was before we went to war with Afghanistan and before we went to war with Iraq. And, of course, do you think that we were right in going to Iraq, considering all the people that have died in the meantime? Or do you think we were justified in attacking Iraq in the name of fighting terrorism?
I think that the president was justified in deciding, it was a very difficult decision, whether the risks of going to war were outweighed by the risks of leaving Saddam Hussein in power.
But, of course, was Saddam Hussein in any way associated with what happened on 9/11?
Well, he was not associated as a conspirator in the 9/11 attack, but after 9/11, what the top administration officials were focused on was not merely retaliating for the 9/11 attack, but preventing follow-on attacks. And the concern was that we had to look at the broader terrorist network from which the next attacks might come.
And I thought
we weren't focused only on the groups, the individuals in the group that had done 9/11.
And, of course, you made that point very, very well in your... But then, of course, the groups that were financing terrorism were Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and the Soviet Union. I mean, what are we going to do about them? They were backing, and you mentioned that point in your book, that the Soviets were actually backing terrorism, and yet we continue our close relationship with the Soviets. Isn't that sort of incongruous?
Well, the terrorist network, which was a network of the terrorist organizations and their various state supporters, we looked at comprehensively.
Right.
And the point that you raise is a good one, that we needed to have, if we're going to have a strategy to fight the terrorist network and do everything we can to prevent the next attack, we needed a strategy for dealing with each element of the network, which included countries like Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and then the main state supporters of terrorism like Iran and Iraq and Libya and Syria and North Korea and others. And what the administration did was it developed strategies for dealing with all of those different actors. It wasn't the same strategy for all of them. It was particular approaches to each.
I think really, of course, one of the very, very important points you bring up is, of course, that this so-called war on terror was really, of course, a war on a series of countries that, in one way or another, were, of course, associated with terrorism, and yet Pakistan had been financing this terrorist movement. Certainly Saudi Arabia is a major financier of it. And, of course, they continue, as far as I can tell, financing these radical Islamic jihadists throughout the world and training them. How could we then justify financing Pakistan today?
Well, Pakistan actually became, after 9/11, an important partner of ours in the war in Afghanistan to overthrow the Taliban regime.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment, and we're going to bring some other stations on board, Mr. Feith, so we will sort of reintroduce you again, and we'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Mr. Douglas Feith, who was formerly an Undersecretary of Defense in the Defense Department and in charge of planning. Certainly, he has written an excellent book called War and Decision. That's War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. And he talks really about the decision that the President made. Immediately after the 9/11 attack, that we were not simply going to deal with this as if it were an isolated criminal act. We were going to declare war on terrorism and of all the various states that were involved in terrorism. And yet, and of course he names a number of them here, I mean Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and Syria and Iran and Iraq and North Korea and Libya. These are all countries that were supporting terrorism. And we were going to, at least correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Feith, but we were going to deal with all of these countries, and we were going to have such a response that everybody would be afraid. Every Islamist who was thinking of joining this radical Islamic movement would be fearful of the retribution we would bring on people who supported terrorism. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, what we were really concerned about was we wanted to try to make a maximum disruption,
right,
of the terrorists so that we could interfere with whatever plans they had to attack us to follow on 9/11. And one of the big problems we had was that we didn't have intelligence about where a lot of the key terrorist actors were. And so we couldn't hit them directly. And part of the strategy that the president and his team developed after 9/11 was hit those parts of the terrorist network. And when I say hit, I mean hit them either with law enforcement or financial or diplomatic or, in some cases, military means. But find ways to pressure and push the parts of the network that were visible. And that meant, you know, where we knew their address. And that meant, for example, leading state supporters. And if we could put pressure on the leading state supporters to change their policies and get out of the terrorism business, then they might pull the reins in on the terrorist groups with whom they deal, and that way we could have an important but indirect effect on the terrorist groups. Because we didn't have the option, because of our lack of intelligence, to hit directly at the terrorist groups, about whom we were concerned. So we combined direct action against the terrorists when we had the intelligence and indirect action through hitting state supporters when we didn't have the intelligence on the specific terrorist group.
Hold that there for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mr. Douglas Feith, formerly with the Defense Department and very, very close to Donald Rumsfeld and even to the President of the United States, as the decisions were being made on the so-called war on terrorism. Well, of course, terrorism is an act. It's not a nation. And yet, of course, in your book, you write about Claire Sterling's book, written some years before the 9/11 attack. And Claire Sterling's book is written about terrorism, pointing out that the Soviet Union was one of the major financiers of terrorism. And, of course, you point out in your book, although she was initially scoffed at, that there was a great deal of truth in what she'd written. Do you still feel that way?
I do. And that was a very important, interesting part of history that there was a big debate in the 1970s and going into the early 1980s about the international terrorist apparatus. And Claire Sterling was one of the people who made the argument that these various terrorist groups in Japan, Germany, Italy, Armenian groups, Arab groups, and others were actually a network. And they had interactions, and sometimes they helped each other with explosives, sometimes they helped each other with training and finances. And this network had important connections to the Soviet Union, which used them to serve Soviet purposes. Now, it didn't mean that all of them were simply Soviet tools. Many of these groups had local grievances. But the fact that they had local grievances didn't mean they were completely independent. And that's why the term network was developed. And when Claire Sterling put that thesis forward, it was very controversial. And an interesting point about that is that Robert Gates, the current Secretary of Defense and the former director of CIA, wrote a book in which he talks about this controversy about the terrorist networks and points out how the CIA took the position that the terrorists weren't a network connected to the Soviet Union, when Alexander Haig, when he was Secretary of State, argued that they were. And Gates points out that the Secretary of State was right and the CIA was wrong. And there were some interesting parallels in the disputes between intelligence officials and policy officials in the George W. Bush administration.
Well, of course, you make a number of very interesting points. Of course, the initial discussions came about, what are we going to do? Who are we going to attack? We're going to attack somebody. And, of course, the point was, well, we really don't have convincing proof that Osama bin Laden was involved. We couldn't prove it in the case of law. But, of course, we do have intelligence. And so why don't we go ahead and attack Afghanistan? But, of course, this was the reason that they would never really bring forward the evidence against Osama bin Laden, because they really did not have proof that would hold up in a courtroom, did they?
Well, I think we actually, over time, did develop evidence that would stand up in court. But in the first hours after 9/11, all we had, as you rightly point out, was intelligence. And intelligence is basically the government's best understanding of the situation, based on usually incomplete, somewhat sketchy information. But it's the best information that the government has. And I think it was actually fairly impressive that the CIA, rather quickly after 9/11, came to the conclusion that it was bin Laden and al-Qaeda that had done that attack. And then, of course, later we got the video of Osama bin Laden confessing, as it were, boasting.
But can we really trust that? I mean, how do we know that in CIA disinformation? After all, they say in wartime the first enemy, the first victim is the truth.
I mean, I don't think there's that anybody has seriously questioned whether bin Laden was behind the 9/11 attack. I think that's pretty well established.
Well, the FBI certainly doesn't. If you look at their website, they don't even list him, as being involved with that in the 10 most wanted posters that they have. And when people have contacted them, they say we have no evidence he was involved. So, well, maybe that's just a mute point. But certainly, we attacked Afghanistan because we wanted to get Osama bin Laden. And then, of course, when we didn't get Osama bin Laden, we've just stayed on. And we've been almost 7 years in this war in Afghanistan, where we're fighting the Taliban, or we're being funded and using Pakistan as the sanctuary. Why don't we go to war with Pakistan? After all, they were the ones who funded the Taliban.
So they did initially support the Taliban, but and after 9/11, the Pakistani government was given a choice of whether they wanted to continue to support the Taliban, or in light of 9/11, did they want to switch and become a partner of the United States in fighting the Taliban. And President Musharraf decided that he wanted to be our partner. And so he provided important military support to the United States in Operation Enduring Freedom, which was the military operation to overthrow the Taliban. And the reason we went to war in Afghanistan was not simply to get bin Laden. That would have made it into a law enforcement operation rather than a war. We went to war in Afghanistan because the president made the point that governments that harbor and support terrorists who attack the United States are going to, as he put it, share the fate of the terrorists. They're going to be treated as we treat the terrorists. And we did that because we understood that our best chance of getting action against the terrorists to disrupt their plans and disrupt their capabilities was by going after not just the terrorist groups, but also their state supporters.
So we really didn't go in to get the Al-Qaeda and bin Laden. We went in to get the Taliban because, of course, they'd let the Osama given him sanctuary there?
No. We went in to do both. We went in to hit Al-Qaeda to the extent we could. And we understood they had some infrastructure, but they were rather light on infrastructure. So as I discuss in the book, I mean, one of the problems was it wasn't clear that even if we hit Al-Qaeda as hard as we could, that we could do them substantial damage, because they were very light in infrastructure, and we figured that if we hit them in Afghanistan, there was a danger they could just pick up and move elsewhere. So we went in to hit Al-Qaeda as hard as we could and disrupt them as much as we could, but also to hit the Taliban so that we could not only deny Al-Qaeda's safe haven in the future in Afghanistan, but also send a signal to all other terrorist-supporting governments around the world that they should get out of the terrorist support business.
But, of course, if we look at the terrorists who attacked America, 50 to the 19 were Saudi Arabians. Maybe we should have attacked Saudi Arabia. Certainly, these were Saudi Arabian citizens, came to the United States from Saudi Arabia, you know, and they attacked the World Trade Center. So, I mean, certainly isn't Saudi Arabia, which funds so much of the world terrorist movement, and funding this radical form of jihad and Wahhabism, don't they bear some responsibility for what's going on?
Well, they do. It's a complex situation, because Al-Qaeda actually considered, you know, on its list of enemies, it had the Saudi Arabian government at the top of its list. I mean, arguably even a higher priority target for Al-Qaeda than the United States. Now, you're correct that the various Saudis, including Saudi government officials, had over the years funded a lot of the mosques and madrasas that were promoting an extreme version of Islam that fed into the terrorist movement, but Al-Qaeda itself considered itself an enemy of the Saudi regime. And what eventually happened was that in late spring of 2003, Al-Qaeda did some bombings in Saudi Arabia that shocked the Saudi government and caused them to reevaluate their policies, and there has been quite a marked change in the Saudi attitude toward suicide bombing and toward some of the radical preaching, and they've actually made some really remarkable changes in their policy, and they launched some major military attacks and police attacks against Al-Qaeda people and radicals in Saudi Arabia.
Well, of course, somebody's got to be financing this worldwide terrorist movement. If it's not Saudi Arabia, is it Pakistan? Is it Iran? Is it the Soviet Union? Certainly we know that Soviet Union's financing Iran, and Iran is financing Hezbollah, which is a terrorist movement. So aren't the people who are financing the people who are financing the terrorists, aren't they responsible for what's going on?
Well, the people financing the terrorists are responsible, and part of the effort of the U.S. government, as I talk about in the book, was to try to cut the terrorist groups off from their sources of financial as well as other resources.
Have we accomplished that, though? I mean, certainly the Taliban are you know, regrouping and even more of a force in Afghanistan than they were a couple of years ago. Somebody's got to be putting the money out for the Taliban today. Who is providing it with weapons? Who is providing it with the funding? Because if you're
some of that is actually coming from the poppy cultivation, the drug trade in Afghanistan.
Well, some of it is, but what about the rest of it? Is it all coming from the poppy trade? And why, when we have a war on drugs, is the United States allowing Afghanistan, which we control for all intents and purposes, to be the major producer of heroin in the world? That just doesn't make sense to me.
Well, it's a lot harder to deal with than simply declaring it illegal. Okay. It is a major problem, and I mean, you're right to highlight it. It's very much at the fore of the minds of American officials. Part of the problem is Afghanistan is a very poor country, and there are very few things that they make that anybody wants to buy, and if their farmers are not going to cultivate poppies, they need to have other crops that that could give them a livelihood.
Well, of course, that's the logical thing. Then why don't we provide them with the know-how and this fertilizer to grow the crops? Why are we
tolerating? There are programs to do that.
But because they are still the major producer of heroin. So obviously, we've been there now since 2001, and here is 7 years into the war. We don't seem to have addressed it very well. Is it that we don't think it's that much of a problem? We don't want to hurt the farmers?
It is a serious problem, but it's a hard problem. And there is an American effort to do it. The British were working on it also. And there's a lot more work that needs to be done there.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Mr. Douglas Feith, and he's been on the front lines of this, this whole situation for a number of years. How long have you been out of government at the present time? Are you
a little over 2.5 years?
Do you miss being there at the center of all these controversies?
Oh no, I was very proud to be able to serve, but I've been very happy to be out and working on the book that I have been working on for the last 2.5 years.
Well, of course, the thing that really bothers me is, of course, that the attack on Saddam Hussein, supposedly because he had weapons of mass destruction, and yet, of course, there was a the administration seemed to be cherry-picking the information, the intelligence they wanted to use to justify an attack. Now, certainly the question is, were they determined to attack Iraq before the 9/11 attack? Certainly Paul O'Neill in his book, The Price of Loyalty, on page 96, says that he was at national security meetings in January and February of the year 2001, six to seven months before the attack, and he heard Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Cheney talking about how we were going to get the American people to go along with a preemptive attack on Iraq, a preemptive attack on Iraq. Now, was he not telling the truth?
Well, what I did in my book is I recount the debates before 9/11 about Iraq, the debates after 9/11 about Iraq, and what I found is that in the various accounts that people put out, there was a lot of loose talk, there was a lot of comments that the administration came into office determined to go to war, that the administration didn't consider options short of war for Iraq. That's not true. And almost every major element of the conventional wisdom about Iraq, I believe, is wrong. And I say that having done the research, first of all, having lived through it, and then secondly, having done the research for my book, where I went back to the written record. People have very peculiar memories about all these kinds of things when they look back after years. And what I wanted to do in my book was not rely on memory or after the fact interviews, but go back and look at the actual written record. And so I, in my book, present the memoranda that were exchanged among Rumsfeld and Powell and Rice and Tenet and Cheney and the President. And when I talk about meetings and say what happened in those meetings and give quotations, they are not things that I'm trying to remember 5 and 6 years after the fact. They're accounts of meetings from the notes that I took while attending those meetings. And I provide footnotes for all of this in my book. And then I also created a website. The name of the book is War and Decision. I created a website called warandecision.com where people who are interested in looking into my endnotes can go in and they can call them up on the website and they can click on the documents and the whole document will appear. And I think it's extremely important that we introduce some serious standards of evidence for these debates, because a lot of what was said about what the administration was doing, what its motivations were, what its reasoning was, I find is wildly inaccurate.
All right, fine. Of course, the major question is, should we have attacked Iraq? And Mr. Feith believes that we were well justified in attacking Iraq, and we'll be back here in just a moment to pursue our discussion. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mr. Douglas Feith, and his book, of course, is War and Decision. Excellent, excellent book. Well worthwhile reading. Now, certainly, we have established the concept of preemptive war. In other words, is there any justification in all of international law for a preemptive attack on somebody because they might attack you in the future?
Well, the dilemma that the president was dealing with is that because of technology, there are actors in the world, states and non-state actors in the world, who have the ability to do enormous harm. I mean, far beyond anything that they could possibly repair after the fact, you know, through reparations, for example. And so traditional concepts of waiting around until an attack is considered to be imminent don't necessarily work in the current era when somebody with, for example, a smallpox weapon could kill hundreds of thousands or possibly millions of people.
So
and
then
we don't have the intelligence to tell us when, you know, somebody might be coming into the United States with a few test tubes full of such a weapon.
Well, where would they get it? I thought that all of these smallpox was under lock and key.
No, there are. Saddam Hussein was working, for example, on smallpox weapons.
Did he actually,
of the things that the United Nations inspectors were intensely concerned about when they were inspecting Iraq after the Gulf War.
Did he actually have smallpox?
Yes, he had smallpox, and he was also working on an item called camelpox, which the UN said was a surrogate. It was a relatively safe way for his people to be working on a highly dangerous substance so that they could develop the technology that they needed to effectively use smallpox as a biological weapon.
But they actually had a specimen of smallpox. Do you have any idea where they got that? Because, of course, supposedly, unless he got it from our good friends the Soviets, all of this is under lock and key. There was none available anywhere in the world. So where would he have gotten smallpox?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I don't know if one goes back and checks the UN inspection documents if they have an answer to that question.
All right, we spend $40 billion a year on intelligence, and you say we just don't have very good intelligence?
Well, intelligence, I don't want to be overly harsh on the CIA. I mean, the CIA has a hard job, but, I mean, there are extremely important, dangerous things, activities that closed societies can pursue, like the pursuit of a nuclear weapon in North Korea or in Iraq or in Iran, where we don't have extremely good insight into what these closed societies do in their closed facilities, sometimes in underground facilities, and during the Cold War, if we were concerned about the Soviets invading Western Europe, we could see the massing of Soviet armored units from satellites. And if the Soviets were going to be launching an attack, we would see the preparations for that from satellites. But when you're talking about the kind of attack that we suffered on 9/11, where people knocked down the World Trade Center towers in New York and attacked the Pentagon, there were no signs that attack was being planned. And, you know, people who say we should wait until an attack is imminent before we take action, I would ask them, when did the 9/11 attack become imminent?
Well, I think I know that Bill Gertz, who gets information from the CIA, put up a Bill Gertz onliner, we have it, in July of the year 2001, talking about Operation Bojica and the plan to attack the World Trade Center and four of our other buildings. So obviously the CIA must have known about it if they gave the information to Bill Gertz. And, of course, certainly that was brought out in a great deal of testimony, but the American people have never heard about that. So obviously there were some people who knew that attack was coming. In fact, that morning of the attack, there were all sorts of, staged military attacks, war games, that involved hijacking planes and crashing them into our buildings. In fact, that morning, the FAA was following something like 29 supposed hijackings, totally confused. So somebody must have known ahead of time what was going to happen.
Well, I mean, people were concerned about attacks on the World Trade Center because the World Trade Center had been attacked in 1993.
Right.
So, I mean, it wasn't the first time, but we did not have the specific information that this attack was underway or was imminent.
Well, certainly, what about that August 6th? I believe it was August 6th. I'm not sure exactly what the date was, but, you know, the presidential briefing that was so controversial where they talked about...
The briefing didn't have details.
Bin Laden planning to attack in America, and we did nothing to stop it. We could have put people on their planes to be sure that they'd be secure, and, well, we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Mr. Douglas Feith. And, of course, he was on the front lines where these decisions were being made and by the president that was going to take us into the current war in Iraq. Would there be possibility that international law would actually hold the president and his advisors guilty for a preemptive strike? I mean, we can justify, because after all, the Chinese communists have the potential to attack us. Maybe we ought to attack them. They're trying to develop nuclear weapons. They actually have nuclear weapons, and maybe we'd be justified in doing something there. But is there any precedent internationally, whether we justify it or not, but in international law for a preemptive strike on a sovereign nation?
The action that we took against Iraq had, I think, a substantial basis in national security analysis and in law. I would refer you, for example, to the resolution that Congress passed on the authorizing the use of force against Iraq. And this was passed with bipartisan support, and it laid out the rationale and the legal and national security rationale for the military action against Iraq. And it cited something like 40 different bases for the action. Iraq was a serious threat to international peace and security for many years, at least a dozen years before the U.S. action in 2003. And the U.N. had passed 16 Security Council resolutions by the time the Bush administration came into office, trying to contain the threat represented by the Saddam Hussein regime. And so one of the things that my book looks at is I review the history. I think a lot of people have forgotten the history, and there are a lot of misconceptions about Iraq. People now say things like, there was no threat from Saddam Hussein. There was no WMD problem in Iraq because we didn't find the stockpiles. That's not correct. There actually was, we found after the war, there was a serious threat, WMD threat from Iraq, even though Saddam had chosen not to maintain the chemical and biological weapons stockpiles that the CIA thought we would find.
Well, of course, now wait a minute, did he have the stockpiles or didn't he?
He did not have the stockpiles, but he did have the programs.
Oh, he had the programs, but then so do the Russians, so do the Chinese, so do the Iranians, so do people all throughout the world.
But there are a number of people that have these programs, but Saddam was a special threat, and he was viewed by the international community as a special threat, which is why the Security Council had passed more resolutions to try to contain him.
Hold that thought. All right, Dr. Stan back here, and Mr. Feith is just talking about the fact that Saddam Hussein was a special threat. He was different than anybody else. He had plans to build nuclear weapons. He didn't seem to have any stockpiles. Pardon me, I should say chemical and biological weapons. He didn't have any stockpiles, but he had certainly the information on how to do it, but then so do a lot of other people.
But it was more than information. What I review in my book is what the Iraq Survey Group found in Iraq after the overthrow of Saddam.
All right, what did they actually find?
What they found was that Saddam Hussein had calculated that he wanted to signal to various enemies that he had chemical and biological weapons stockpiles. But at the same time, he chose not to maintain the stockpiles because he wanted to escape from UN sanctions and wanted to be able to have international inspectors come in when he chose, so that they could inspect the country and not find stockpiles so that he could get out from under the sanctions.
But of course,
he put himself in a position where, even though he didn't maintain the stockpiles, he created the facilities, he created the personnel, and they had the materiel, so that he could manufacture chemical and biological weapons stockpiles in 3 to 5 weeks. And that's what we found after the war. And it was a terrible mistake for the U.S. government to rely on erroneous intelligence, and it damaged us terribly and undermined our credibility. They were honest errors, but even so, it was a disaster that the administration relied on intelligence that turned out to be wrong. But the essence of the problem, the threat that Saddam Hussein represented as a leader, as the head of a regime that had developed and used WMD in the past, the WMD threat was real. And he put himself in a position where he could have had the stockpiles in 3 to 5 weeks. And given the fact that he had a record of having developed WMD and pursued not only chemical and biological weapons, but nuclear weapons, and he was one of the only regimes in the world that had actually used chemical weapons, Saddam was the first person in history to use nerve gas on the battlefield, and he used it against the Iranians in the Iran-Iraq war, and then he used WMD against his own Kurds in the late 80s when he attacked his own Kurdish citizens.
And certainly that is totally unconscionable, but after all, certainly it was during the 1980s that the United States was financing and backing Saddam Hussein. Aren't the people who financed and backed him as equally responsible for this wicked man being in power?
No, it's not correct that the United States was backing his use of chemical weapons. That's just wrong.
Well, but where did he get the material for the chemical weapons?
I don't believe he got it from us.
Well, of course, according to the Washington Post, I'd be glad to censor the article that they wrote. Of course, you may not agree with the Washington Post, but many people believe that, of course, American government allowed the materials for the chemical and biological warfare to be sent to Saddam, but that's neither here nor there. Certainly, we've been embarrassed by what's happened there as far as the world is concerned, and you have a section in your book about Abu Ghraib. How can we ever live down the humiliation of what our troops did there? And, of course, there are many people, including Major General Taguba, who was ordered to investigate what happened to Abu Ghraib and told that if he told the truth, it would ruin his career, and he told the truth, and, well, he was ordered to resign, but he claims that this went right up to the very top of our government, orders for the torture and humiliation and sexual humiliation that took place at Abu Ghraib. Haven't we embarrassed ourselves throughout the world?
I must say, I that is completely false.
Have you read Major General Taguba's report?
I read the original Taguba report, and it did not say that that what you just said.
No, of course it didn't.
That torture was ordered. I mean, torture is illegal. And it was clear that torture is illegal. Again, this is another area where there are terrible misconceptions. And I mean, I think it's just extremely harmful to our country that a lot of this debate is being conducted on the basis of inaccurate information.
Well, all I know is what Seymour Hersh had written in the New York Times, New Yorker, after interviewing General Taguba, but you don't feel that is accurate at all?
No.
And you don't feel that the administration ever authorized torture?
No, torture is illegal.
All right, but of course then...
And what happened at Abu Ghraib was you had a bunch of people who were engaging in disgusting, sexually perverted behavior. Much of it, by the way, just pornographic photography and activity that had nothing whatsoever even to do with the Iraqis. I mean, a lot of it was just the Americans doing stuff amongst themselves. And then they got a number of Iraqi detainees involved. And, I mean, it was just disgusting, criminal behavior. And as soon as it was brought to the attention of somebody in the military who was not involved in it, they started a criminal investigation, and it was handled properly. And, I mean, this was a terrible embarrassment to the United States. It was enormously damaging to us around the world. I agree with you on that. And it is something that just tainted our activity in Iraq. But it was against American policy, against everything we stand for. It was illegal. And when it was discovered, it was investigated criminally and prosecuted and punished.
And so, to your knowledge, of course, then there was no authorization of this at any time from the upper echelons of our government.
Without a doubt, there was none. It was disgusting. I mean, when people found out about it, it wasn't even authorized at a medium level, let alone at a high level.
All right, then do you feel that Seymour Hersh's reporting then in the New Yorker magazine is totally inaccurate?
If it is what you said, I don't know exactly what reporting you're referring to, but if he said what you said, what you attributed to him, then it's inaccurate.
All right, fine. I will be glad to, if you'd like, we'd be glad to send you a copy of the article out of the New Yorker. I thought it was very revealing, and certainly we need to find out what happened. And then, of course, what about the waterboarding and the mistreatment of some of our prisoners at Guantanamo? Certainly it would frighten anybody else in the terrorist movement, but isn't waterboarding considered torture?
Well, the lawyers have been and apparently continue to debate that. When Attorney General Mukasey was asked about that, he basically refused to come to a conclusion because he said this is debated among lawyers.
But if it's debated, it doesn't matter whether it's debated among lawyers. What do people throughout the world say? I know when John McCain was asked on 60 Minutes about whether it's torture, he said, of course it's torture. And they asked him, well, what happened? And he said, we seem to have lost our way. Now, John McCain is not one of my favorite people, but, I mean, he didn't even hesitate saying it's torture. How could the Attorney General say he doesn't know whether it's torture or not when, of course, you know, everybody else in the world considers it's torture?
Well, I mean, you know, it's hard to deal with a concept like everybody else in the world. I mean, these are, in fact, issues that are debated among serious people.
I see. And so as long as they're debated, then are they justified? Or is just somebody responsible?
Well, this is not an area that I have personally studied. This was not something that I gave an opinion on.
All right, fine. Well, let's get some of the other reports, things you really talked about. And you were very, very, of course, much involved with this idea that people, soldiers, of course, or terrorists who are really involved in conflict and not wearing uniforms would be considered as terrorists and would not be protected by the Geneva Convention. What was that debate all about?
Well, this was a very important subject that I got involved in for the first time in the 1980s. The way the Geneva Conventions were constructed when they were put together after World War II was the drafters of the Geneva Conventions were chiefly interested in protecting civilians. They wanted to make sure that war was not more damaging to civilians than it had to be. They wanted to minimize the damage to civilians. So they said that they wanted to encourage people who fight to fight in a way that protects the interests of civilians. So they said fighters should wear uniforms, they should carry their arms openly, they should comply with the laws of war, and they should be part of a chain of command. And what the Geneva Convention said is, if those four conditions are met, then a fighter is considered a lawful combatant, and if he gets captured, he's entitled to the privileges of prisoner of war status. And prisoner of war status was a privilege that was given to those people who fight in a way that protects the interest of non-combatants. And again, those four conditions were wearing a uniform, carrying your arms openly, complying with the laws of war, and being part of a chain of command. And if somebody did not do those things, then they were not entitled to POW status under the Geneva Convention.
And they would be considered then terrorists?
They would not be considered to be lawful combatants. Okay, they would be unlawful combatants or unlawful fighters. And now, terrorists, of course, are unlawful fighters. I mean, they don't wear uniforms, and they don't comply with the laws of war because terrorists purposefully target civilians, which is a violation of the laws of war. And so what happened was, in the 1970s, there was an effort made to rewrite the Geneva Conventions that had been written originally after World War II. And in the 1970s, a number of countries got together, and they put together an amendment to the Geneva Conventions, and the amendment was called Protocol 1. And Protocol 1 aimed to give POW status to fighters who did not obey the rules. And the United States opposed that, but most of the countries that negotiated it went along with it.
Now, did we sign that at the time?
No, we signed it, but then this is where I came into the story. When President Reagan was in office, and I was at the Pentagon as a deputy assistant secretary, we looked at this treaty, this Protocol 1, which the United States had signed, and we studied it to try to decide whether the president should approve ratification of the treaty. And President Reagan came to the conclusion that it was actually a setback, a step backward in humanitarian law to give terrorist groups more rights and take protections away from civilians, from non-combatants. And so he announced that he was not going to ratify Protocol 1 because he wanted to defend the Geneva Conventions as they were originally drafted. And when he took that position, both the New York Times and the Washington Post praised him for it. Now, as you know, the New York Times and the Washington Post generally did not support President Reagan. But on this issue, they said that President Reagan was right, that terrorists do not deserve POW status, because if you give terrorists POW status, you're undermining the protection that the Geneva Conventions intended to give to civilians.
Well, of course, but isn't a terrorist the person that you oppose? In other words, you always call people that oppose us terrorists. Well, what about the Afghan freedom fighters who were backed by the American CIA in the war against the Soviets? Did they wear regular uniforms?
No. By the way, if you don't wear regular uniforms, you run the risk, if you get captured, of not being given POW privileges.
But then we were financing these people who were not wearing uniforms, who were fighting a legitimate government.
It's not illegal to be a so-called irregular force. It's just that irregular forces under the Geneva Conventions don't get the same protections that regular forces get.
I see. And so basically the United States then unilaterally decided, against, of course, the decision of so many of the other countries, the majority of the other countries, that we were no longer going to abide by the Geneva Convention.
No, that's absolutely wrong. We, on the contrary, said we are going to abide by the Geneva
Convention.
Well,
in other words, we were going to ignore Protocol 1, which had been put forward.
But that was our right. Protocol 1 was a new treaty. We were not obliged to endorse a new treaty.
But we'd signed it, hadn't we?
But when you sign it, that under international law, when you sign a treaty, you then have the right to decide, after studying it, whether you want to ratify.
Oh, I see. So you signed it, but we didn't ratify it then, is
and
that
we,
it?
Right. We did not ratify it. And to this day, we have not ratified it because it was considered by successive U.S. governments to be a step backward from what the Geneva Conventions had staked out as a proper position of concern and protection for non-combatants.
Well, of course, one of the things I think that really a lot of people are concerned about is that an awful lot of people were rounded up in Pakistan and Afghanistan. The government was apparently giving a certain amount of money if anybody had turned into a terrorist, and they were giving several thousand dollars. A lot of people got turned in and ended up at Guantanamo, and of course had to go through at Guantanamo, and they were perfectly innocent civilians. They'd done nothing at all, and yet, of course, under this idea of unlawful combatants, you could take these people in and certainly mistreat them and deprive them of sleep. And
first of all, it's not true. Everybody was given, even those people who were not given POW status, were given humane treatment. and so they were supposed to be given humane treatment. I can't say that that there weren't, again, as in Abu Ghraib, sometimes you get people who work for the United States who just misbehave and engage in criminal behavior.
But how about
and then that gets punished when it gets discovered. But the policy was that the president promulgated, the policy was that all of our detainees, including those who are not entitled to POW status, were entitled to humane treatment.
But how about those that we for instance, who transferred to Jordan or Egypt so they could be tortured there? And the CIA would take them over, and so we couldn't torture them. We let them do it.
I'm really familiar with what the Defense Department was doing. There's all kinds of stuff written about what the CIA was doing. I don't consider myself an expert on that.
All right. Well then,
sense is that a lot of that's been written on that subject is as inaccurate as you know much of the other material. This has been the debates on these subjects have been so bitter, and the standards for people bringing forward issues with care and evidence have been so sloppy that I would just say that, you know, people...
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you up in the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to complete our interview with Mr. Feith. But, of course, those things happen electronically. This is the time, of course, we need to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America. Really 5 hours every day and then a weekend program. And altogether we have about 60 outlets every single week. But of course it's an expensive proposition, and if you're in a position to help us, we'd love to hear from you. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And we'd love to welcome you into the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Now, this is the time I really want to once again reiterate the fact that if you're not getting yourself prepared for the coming period of chaos and crisis, you really need to. People need to, of course, start laying in food supplies. As you know, there's already a shortage of food developing here. And, of course, Costco and other major chains, they're limiting the amount of rice that you can actually buy. And, of course, we find that talking to our supplier, Ready Reserve Food, they're having increasing difficulty getting rice and certain of the other products that they put together. They have enough supplies now for the time being. But where are we going to be 6 months or a year from now? I have no idea. But what I certainly do hope is that many of you out there, if you've not already laid in adequate supply, will certainly do so. Our telephone number, if you'd like to get an emergency food catalog, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And we do hope that we'll send you an emergency food catalog and the other things that you would need if there really was an emergency situation. Again, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and we'll send you an emergency food catalog. We'll send you a health products catalog. We'll go ahead and send you a catalog, just a regular Radio Liberty, and you can get some of the tape sets we have that will provide you with the information you really need to know about Iraq. And certainly what led up to Iraq, we have a three-pamphlet set called Foreknowledge 911. That's Foreknowledge 911. And, of course, then we have an update on that entitled The True Story of 911. And you haven't got the true story of 911. Certainly, four-star Marine General Anthony Zinni, who was in charge of CENTCOM, he was the commander of CENTCOM, he says there was absolutely no reason to attack Iraq. He had all of the information that everybody else had, and there was no reason to attack Iraq. We've been bombing them three or four times a week for the better part of 10 years. They were totally incapacitated. Their military didn't function well. The infrastructure of their society was totally destroyed, and there was no reason to attack Iraq. Well, either four-star Marine General Anthony Zinni is not telling the truth, or the people who justify the attack are not telling the truth. And a million civilians have died. So we hope that you'll want to get the information. Where did the radical Islamic movement come from? It came from the American CIA and British intelligence. That's why you need to get the book, The Devil's Game, because, of course, who financed this whole incredible resurgence of the radical Islam? Your tax dollars, ladies and gentlemen. Your tax dollars. We have a wonderful article that came out of the Washington Post. We'll send it to you if you request it by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, the article simply is entitled, When the ABCs of Jihad, going to the fact that the USAID, United States Agency for International Development, actually put out $51 million. $51 million that were used to print textbooks to push this radical form of Islam, to indoctrinate the young men who eventually joined the Taliban, and of course were slaughtering over there in Afghanistan today. That we'll be glad to send you the article free of charge, The ABCs of Jihad. And then pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty. Our number 1-800-544-8927.
You're listening to the Global Star Radio Network, located at Telstar 5 KU band, frequency 11836, symbol rate 20770. Thank you for listening.